Saturday, March 2nd, Bahrain Grand Prix marks the 20th anniversary of the inaugural race. For the country's rulers, it is a time for special celebrations to mark Bahrain's landmark 20th anniversary in motorsport. For pro-democracy activists from Bahrain, including the Bahrain Institute for Rights and Democracy, the race is testament to a troubling 20-year legacy of sports washing in Bahrain. Sayed Al-Wadai, Birds Advocacy Director, attended the first Bahrain Grand Prix, getting in with a free ticket the authorities handed out to all school and university students because they wanted to make sure there was a substantial crowd. He told MEE, "The government made a big deal about it. I went, but we didn't understand what was going on. We could just hear lots of very noisy cars." Today, Al-Wadai, who is one of the most prominent Bahraini activists in the world, says that what hurts the most is when F1 makes truly astonishing false claims that it is a force for good. How can this be the case when your partners won't tolerate any form of protest? Bahrain's human rights record over the past 20 years has become significantly worse, with a major setback in 2011 when the mass protest movement was crushed and the race was cancelled. The Bahraini activist had been joined by a group of British politicians, including former Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn and former Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell, who wrote to F1's leadership on February 28. The MPs and Lords wrote, "While F1 remains delusional about its impact, evidence illustrates that the human rights situation in Bahrain has significantly deteriorated over the past two decades." They highlighted the case of Salah Abbas Habib, a 36-year-old anti-government protester who was found dead on the eve of the Bahrain Grand Prix in 2012. The motorsport has not investigated whether the death was linked to its presence in the island kingdom. A spokesperson for F1 told MEE, "For decades, Formula One has worked hard to be a positive force everywhere in races, including economic, social, and cultural benefits. Sports like Formula One are uniquely positioned to cross borders and cultures to bring countries and communities together to share the passion and excitement of incredible competition and achievement. We take our responsibilities on rights very seriously and set high ethical standards for counterparts and those in our supply chain, which are enshrined in contracts, and we pay close attention to their adherence."
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, how can we change that bad habit of ours? Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is an honor to be here at your service. Dear listeners, we are talking about how can we just get rid of that bad habit of ours when it comes to our Islamic lifestyle. Now, there's a couple of things that we need to take into consideration when we are talking about a bad habit. So first and foremost, you know, there are certain bad habits which are, you know, they're not really religiously considered to be bad habits. I don't know, they're just kind of these things that we have, you know, we've become accustomed to doing over the years, but there are certain bad habits which are religiously considered to be bad habits. So, for example, lying or backbiting or cheating or stealing. I don't know. These are things that are very apparently and very overtly they're bad habits. God forbid that they don't become habits, but they are bad habits that are religiously, prohibited bad habits. But, some things are not religiously prohibited bad habits. I mean, so I don't know, for example, you have it could be considered a bad habit, that you like to put your fork on the right side of your plate or something like that. I don't know, the things that are not religiously prohibited. Now, we're talking about primarily those habits which are religiously prohibited. These kind of negative qualities that appear, in a human being, and how to fix that. So that is primarily what we're talking about on this session. Now, how do we get rid of these bad habits? Well, we already talked about the first aspect and the first step, which is to be able to identify, what bad habit we're talking about and what bad habit we need to fix within ourselves. So the first step, of course, is to be able to identify what it is that we are doing, which is a religiously prohibited bad habit, so that slowly but surely we can work on that and hopefully be able to get rid of that pesky little bad habit. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we are talking about how to get rid of that Islamically prohibited bad habit so that we can achieve that ultimate Islamic lifestyle. Now, of course, this takes time. It takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of practice. Unfortunately, sometimes we grow up and we pick up these bad habits. And as we said, religiously prohibited bad habits over the years. And then, when we become relative adults and we grow up, if you will, we realize that these habits have become a part of us, and they become, much more difficult to be able to handle and to be able to remove from ourselves. And this here is something that's really important for any parent out there, is to make sure that you get rid of these bad habits in your children before they grow up and before these things become a habit. And especially those habits which are religiously prohibited. And this is one of the perhaps one of the greatest responsibilities of a parent, and that is to be able to help to control certain religiously prohibited bad habits that might, become habits for their children. So anyways, it takes a lot of time. Of course, we said that the first step is to be able to identify that this is a bad habit, and then you kind of make a plan of action in order to prevent yourself from falling into that bad habit, in order to protect yourself from being in a situation where you are, kind of forced to fall into that bad habit. And make sure that, you remove yourself from any kind of situations that will push you towards that bad habit, whether it's lying or stealing or whatever it may be. You have to identify. And then it's a relatively long process. Don't think that it's going to be, overnight you're going to be able to fix all of your bad habits. No, it takes time. It takes perseverance. It takes determination, and some of these spiritual wayfaring masters, they have said that it has taken them a whole lifetime to be able to control something. And there are some who have said that despite being able to control a certain bad habit for their whole lifetime, they are still afraid and they are still very careful because they might fall into the same trap. But nonetheless, the fact that you are trying to remove that bad habit is something which is commendable, and it will eventually, inshallah, by the grace and the blessings of Allah, it will help you to attain that Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. U.S. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar has said the Biden administration greenlighted the Israeli regime's massacre of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. She denounced Washington's arms aid to Israel as state-sponsored violence. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. China's Xinhua News Agency has covered this story and tells us more. The United Nations Human Rights Chief has expressed dismay concerning the brutality with which the Israeli regime is leading its ongoing months-long war of genocide in Gaza. Volker Turk told the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva, Switzerland, on Thursday, 29th of February, there appear to be no bounds to and no words to capture the horrors that are unfolding before our eyes in Gaza. Tens of thousands of Palestinians, many of them women and children, have been massacred as a result of the Israeli military's onslaught in Gaza. Israel launched its campaign on 7th of October last year, following the Al-Aqsa storm operation, a surprise operation by Gaza's resistance movement against the occupied Palestinian territories. Volker Turk condemned the brutality of the Israeli response as appalling and entirely wrong. Meanwhile, the UN official warned about the pending dire consequences of a ground invasion that the Israeli regime has threatened to stage against the southern Gaza city of Rafah. More than 1.5 million of Gaza's 2.4 million plus population have fled to Rafah in southern Gaza Strip, finding nowhere else safe across the coastal sliver. Volker Turk said such a ground assault would contravene the orders issued by the United Nations highest court. On 26th of January, the International Court of Justice at The Hague, Netherlands, said Israel had to prevent the commission of all acts within the scope of the Genocide Convention. Volker Turk said, "I fail to see how such an operation could be consistent with the binding provisional measures issued by the International Court of Justice. The prospect of an Israeli ground assault on Rafah would take the nightmare being inflicted on the Palestinians of Gaza into a new dimension." Turkey's Anadolu News Agency has also covered the same story. The European Union has wrapped a recent unjustifiable attack by the Israeli occupation forces on Palestinian civilians seeking food aid in the besieged Gaza Strip, calling for an international investigation into the deadly incident. In a statement on Saturday, 2nd of March, the European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell condemned the restrictions imposed by Israel on the entry of humanitarian aid into Gaza and the opening of Gaza's crossing points. He said the firing by Israeli troops on civilians trying to access foodstuff is unjustifiable. Josep Borrell added, "We request an impartial international investigation on this tragic event, allowing for a clear picture of the events and responsibilities." At least 112 people were martyred and more than 750 others were injured on Thursday, 29th of February, as the Israeli military opened fire on Palestinians who had surrounded a convoy of 38 aid trucks in Gaza, with the Palestinian Health Ministry calling the incident a massacre. The latest Israeli crime comes as non-governmental organizations and United Nations experts have on several occasions voiced fears of famine in Gaza. Gaza has been completely cut off from aid by the Israeli regime since October of last year. The European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell emphasized that Israel shoulders responsibility of complying with the rules of international law and to protect the distribution of humanitarian aid to the civilian population of Gaza. The top EU diplomat pointed out the responsibility for this incident lays on the restrictions imposed by the Israeli army and obstructions by violent extremists to the supply of humanitarian aid. Josep Borrell warned that the restrictions on the entry of humanitarian assistance contribute to creating scarcity, hunger and disease, saying it would also lead to a level of desperation that brings about violence. He added, "Unabated fighting and disregard for international humanitarian law will lead to complete chaos, making the distribution of humanitarian aid impossible." Josep Borrell stressed the need to restore a minimum of order and security in Gaza to preserve a humanitarian space. Borrell added, "We urge Israel to fully cooperate with the United Nations agencies and other humanitarian actors involved in the humanitarian response and to allow free, unimpeded and safe humanitarian access through all crossing points in Gaza." The EU's top diplomat also urged Israel to swiftly remove the obstacles at the Kerem Shalom crossing and open the access in the north at Karni and Eretz crossings, to open the port of Ashdod to humanitarian aid and to allow a direct humanitarian corridor from Jordan into Gaza. He emphasized that airdrops should be a solution of last resort given their minimal impact and their risk to civilians. Borrell also urged the United Nations Security Council to call for an urgent cessation of hostilities in Gaza. The American newspaper The Hill has also covered the same story. U.S. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar has said the Biden administration greenlighted the Israeli regime's massacring of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Ilhan Omar denounced Washington's arms aid to Israel, calling it state-sponsored violence. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar made the statement at a press conference on Thursday, 29th of February, along with other U.S. lawmakers, including Representative Rashida Tlaib, Democrat of Michigan, as she voiced concerns about the high death toll of Palestinian civilians and the displacement of over 1 million people in the Gaza Strip, criticizing the Biden administration for approving additional aid to Israel without congressional approval. Ilhan Omar said, "This administration cannot claim to be an honest broker of peace while greenlighting the massacring of Palestinians in Gaza." The restocking of Israel's arsenal is not foreign policy, it is state-sponsored violence waged against defenseless families who want only to live in peace. Ilhan Omar stressed, if we truly want to uplift humanity to protect the innocent people of Gaza, to bring hostages safely home, to hold out hope for peace, then we must demand a ceasefire in Gaza right now. Ilhan Omar also expressed disappointment with the response from the United States and the world's political leaders to Israeli atrocities in Gaza, underlining that empty rhetoric about human rights without any meaningful action is unacceptable. The Democratic Congresswoman from Minnesota said the Biden administration's policies lack effective pressure on Israel and fail to deter the Israeli regime from continuing with its crimes against Palestinians. Ilhan Omar added, despite the clarity surrounding Gaza's despair, the response from political leaders has been nothing short of callous. Empty rhetoric about human rights ring hollow when no action follows. She added, this administration's policies fail to meaningfully pressure the Israeli regime through restrictions, sanctions, or any hint of consequences. Each war crime and violation compiled by journalists, human rights groups, and United Nations agencies are bearing witness.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pit.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam ID. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. Welcome back to a new episode of
Youth Station.
I am Beta, and with me
is Mustafa.
Okay, so once again, we have the opportunity to be here talking about some controversial issues and topics. I'm studying medicine, and at medical university, everybody is like, for example, oh, are you studying medicine? Then you must be this, you must be so smart, intelligent, you must, for example, sacrifice a lot of time to studying.
Are you not doing that?
No, are you not like... I'm the one that are doing this, but there are so many people at my university that they don't care about studying, and it's okay in their major and in the science or knowledge of medicine, and, you know, it's one of the habits of people to generalize things into other groups of people. For example, because they don't have enough knowledge of the uniqueness of individuals, they will feel like, for example, if you are from this group of people, then you have this characteristic. So have you ever experienced this kind of situation that, for example, because of your nation or because of your country, they kind of connect you to a specific attribute or not?
Of course, definitely. And I've lived in different countries, you know, so I've lived among different cultures.
Yeah.
And, you know, stereotyping cultures or people is very common, by the way, very, very common. And, you know, there's actually positives to it and negatives as well.
Right? Yeah.
The sort of the positive things that come out of stereotypes is that, you know, as human beings, we're pattern-seeking creatures. Have you ever heard that?
No.
So one of the, you know, science that they talk about, a human being, you know, everything that we do is actually through pattern recognition.
Yeah.
Right? For example, when reading is a way of pattern recognition, right? Every symbol means something. So when we generalize things, what we're really looking at is like we're looking at a pattern among a certain group of people, and that's it becomes a stereotype. And that can be helpful in situations. I'm trying to think of like when that can be helpful. Can you think of a situation where that can be? I know there are places where it can be helpful.
You know, I believe actually there is a proverb in my culture that we say there should be something if you hear something about a group of people. So, for example, if we say this group of people are like that, there must be a kind of background to this group that this attribute or this characteristic is connected to this group. For example, when you go through a new country and most of the people, for example, say, oh, this country, the people of this country are not very good to strangers or to the people of other countries. And when you go through the atmosphere of that country, you see, yeah, it's like that. I mean, it's not completely a big lie to generalize a thing. When you generalize, it means that you watch that behavior repeatedly. So there is something. Right. I mean, there is a basis of truth behind the stereotypes. It's not like, for example, all stereotypes are lie.
Right. But you know where it does become harmful is when you start attributing those negative stereotypes to individuals, right? Let's say now you learned that I'm from Pakistan. Whatever negative stereotypes exist in your head about Pakistan, you start applying them to me.
Exactly.
Which may not necessarily be true about me specifically, right? Those things may exist maybe in my culture among certain people, but every individual is different, right? Not every individual follows like every aspect of their culture.
For sure. And, you know, it happens a lot because our brain tends to connect different information together.
That's the pattern recognition right there. Yeah,
this is a pattern. For example, if you have a car accident and at that day you, for example, saw a black cat, your brain kind of connects these two information together. And after that, you always attribute this characteristic of bad luck to a bad cat. This is the exact thing that happens in stereotype when, for example, you connect this characteristic to a specific nation, as you mentioned. So let's talk more about the negative parts of a stereotype after a short break.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Youth Station, and we were talking about the good and bad dimensions of stereotype.
Right. And, you know, one of the negatives, unfortunately, I think we all realize is that it makes us racist or prejudiced against certain people. That's, I think, one of the biggest things that we see, that people become racist against others. And in turn, they start thinking they're better than others.
Yeah.
Right? That's definitely one of the biggest negatives that I can think of.
Discrimination, racism, and these kind of consequences of a stereotype are the things that we can see in the world around us. And this is not something far away, because most of the people think, like, for example, oh, racism. We are at 21st century, and at this age, we don't have any racism. Yeah. But it's not like that. When you go and travel through different countries and different cultures, you will understand that there is something like that. And another point is that most of the time, a lack of understanding of the uniqueness of individuals and the depth of everybody's soul will lead you to stereotype and generalizing a kind of belief to a combination.
For example, I've definitely created stereotypes in my mind, you know, for certain groups of people.
Yeah.
And it's because I see them as being true many times. For example, I might say, you know, Indians are like hardworking people. You know, I might say like one stereotype. So I used to work in a university.
Yeah.
And, you know, computer science, I used to interact with a lot of computer science students, many different students. One of the stereotypes that's in my mind is a lot of people that have studied computer science, their social skills aren't that great.
Yeah, okay. Like the example I gave you at the beginning of our episode.
Of course, but there's always exceptions to these, right?
Yeah.
To these sort of stereotypes.
But, and, you know, most of the people say, like, exceptions don't break the rule.
I'm saying, my point was that because of the exceptions, you have to be open-minded.
Yeah.
You don't have to be, don't be judgmental from the first, you know, from the very beginning. You can have that stereotype in the back of your mind about those people. Then once you interact with them, they may be proven or disproven.
Yeah.
Right? So you have to be open-minded to sort of anything could happen, because a human being is a very complex creature. You know, you can't really put us all in like one box or one label. So that my solution to that is keeping my mind open, right?
Yeah.
Not being judgmental about people, despite having those those stereotypes. A lot of times when I tell people that I'm studying psychology, they're like, well, tell me about me, you know? Tell me about myself.
Oh, my God, yeah.
I'm like, well, I can't just like look at you and tell you about yourself. You know, they think I can like read their mind or something. That's not what psychology is, right?
Yeah.
Psychology is a big part is getting the person to talk to you and tell you about themselves.
Exactly.
That's one of the main sort of ways to do that. One technique that I think really helps, a psychological technique that I sometimes use in my interactions, is sympathy and empathy.
Yeah.
Okay. What do I mean by that? When I speak to people, I try to understand like what's their pain point, right? What's causing them those difficulties or pains in their life? And you try to empathize with that. You put yourself in their place, no matter what it is. Even if it's something that I would never do, but I see that other person doing, I try to understand why they're doing it. What's the cause behind it? And that's made me so much like relaxed with people. It's made me so much, people do start telling me their secrets because of just this technique. Right?
Yeah.
People start telling me things about their lives, which would probably never happen before. So one way to dealing with stereotypes is that, you know, or people, is you sympathize and empathize with them and try to understand what's the reason behind that behavior rather than like trying to judge them for that behavior.
Yeah, I got it. One of the problems that this stereotype actually poses in my way as a medical student is that most of the people have this picture of an old man with white hair and white, mustache as a doctor. And for example, when they see a woman, which is, for example, mostly young, as a doctor, they cannot believe or they cannot put their trust into that person. This is one of the stereotypes that, I have a lot of problem with. And, it feels like, oh my God, I have to be too old to get the trust of people in my major or in my job.
I'll have to look at your handwriting to figure out if you're really a doctor or not, because doctors have the worst handwritings. I'm not even joking. Like, this is a stereotype that I have to believe in, okay? I don't know why this has happened 3 or 4 times. I got a prescription.
Yeah.
I had to post it on a group to ask people, like, hey, what's written here?
But there is a reason, I believe, for any stereotype. For example, the reason of this bad handwriting of doctors is that they don't have enough time because there are so many patients there. And, for example, when you're a first-year medical student, then you have a beautiful handwriting, delicately, you're trying to put the details. But when you go higher and higher, you will understand that there is no need for you to actually waste your time and these beauties and delicate points of your job. And that's enough only to, for example, write the first letter of the drug or something like that, and the nurse will understand it. Let's go for sure.
Sure. So we're back from the break, and I was saying that, you know, the way we use stereotypes can be beneficial, actually. And the one place that came to my mind is, for example, it's used a lot in statistics and research. Right? One of the ways that, for example, research is done is you take a sample of a group, right, about any topic. And based off of that sample, you create generalizations, right? So it's very helpful in places like research and trying to, like, better understand whatever that question is.
Yeah.
Right? That's where it can be helpful.
I believe for every single thing in this world, there is a good dimension and there is a bad dimension. And it's the same for a stereotype or generalization whenever we talk about the people. And as you mentioned, we shouldn't put the whole trust in this generalization and have this background about people of a specific group that every individual of that group have the quality that we are talking about. It's not like that. The thing is, as we mentioned, there are both beneficial parts and actually detrimental parts of this stereotype. But at the end of the day, we have to keep that in mind. Every individual is unique because Allah Almighty wants us to be unique and actually created us in a manner that we have a specific characteristics, a specific personality, and even one of the signs of our uniqueness is the imprint of our fingers. Okay, every human being and every individual has different imprints, and I believe this is a blessing for us to be unique, but still it doesn't mean that we don't have anything in common with each other. So if there is a good stereotype for your country, for your nation, good for you. Just let's prove it to other people that you have this characteristic. And if something bad, then you have to communicate with other people and talk to them in order to correct this mindset about your nation.
You know, one of the things that I do, what happens is when I do hear negative stereotypes, like, for example, about my own country or culture, I try to break those stereotypes. Stereotypes, right?
Exactly.
So it can kind of work in reverse as well, that rather than you stereotyping others, you try to like change yourself so that you don't look like them anymore, right? That's something that a lot of people do, you know, and they see that they're being viewed in a certain way, and then they will be motivated to change that sort of. I really believe in breaking stereotypes as well, especially negative stereotypes. I think that should be something that we should all be doing.
Yeah.
Right? Because there's definitely negative things that have come up in our tradition and cultures. From an Islamic point of view, I would say, you know, the Quran has continuously said, you know, has criticized those people who followed their ancestors' religion.
Yeah,
right? That in a way, because they're saying, look, you, even us, right? Even my ancestors, who are all Sayyid and, you know, we're Shia, I would still say that, you know, if I were to accept everything that my ancestors gave me,
that would be prejudice.
That would be bad, right? God says you should be thinking for yourself. You should be pondering for yourself and reaching the truth yourself.
Exactly.
Right? So that's how I can sort of relate it to this topic, is that our ancestor stereotypes, we need to break them. We need to bring about a revolution in the way, the traditions, the bad traditions and things that we have in our culture.
And I believe that was the gist of what we talked up to here. Thank you for sharing it with us, brother. And thank you, dear listeners, for listening to us. That was all the time we had for today's episode. Wassalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you, dear youth, will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings, be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about this.
We'll discuss that inshallah in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum.
Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum. Wassalamu alaikum. Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Latif. Ya Latif. Ya Latif. Ya Latif.
In the limelight.
Donald Trump is looming large in the race to succeed the outgoing Senate GOP leader Mitch McConnell. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The American newspaper The Daily Beast has covered this story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump has quietly been encouraging Senator Steve Daines, Republican of Montana, to mount a campaign to succeed Senator Mitch McConnell as the Senate's Republican leader. Daines confirmed to Politico on Thursday following reports that he had gained the former president's support. Senator Steve Daines said he thanked Donald Trump for the vote of confidence but wouldn't say whether he was planning to follow through with a run for Senate leadership, adding, "I told Trump the most important thing I can do this moment is to make sure we have a Senate majority in November." It's the first hint to emerge out of Donald Trump's camp about the former president's preference for Mitch McConnell's replacement and comes just a day after McConnell announced he wouldn't run for the position again. Senator Steve Daines has been Trump's preferred pick to lead the Senate GOP even prior to McConnell's surprise announcement on Wednesday. The Montana Republican hasn't been mentioned as a successor to Mitch McConnell as often as three of his colleagues who've been referred to as the Three Johns since last year. Those favorites include the current number two Republican in the chamber, John Thune, Republican of South Dakota, the former number two Republican, John Cornyn, Republican of Texas, and Senate GOP Conference Chairman John Barrasso, Republican of Wyoming. Of those three, only John Cornyn has announced his intentions to seek the top leadership position. He did that in an internal statement sent to Republican senators on Thursday, 29th of February, saying his experience as Mitch McConnell's number two should make him the most qualified politician for the job. From experience, I've learned what works in the Senate and what does not, Cornyn said, and I'm confident Senate Republicans can restore our institution to the essential role it serves in our constitutional republic. There's still nearly 9 months to go before the Senate will choose who succeeds Mitch McConnell, who's held the position unopposed since 2007. Unlike the House GOP's messy leadership election last year, the Senate chooses its leader in closed-door conference meetings by secret ballot. Steve Daines, who chairs the National Republican Senatorial Committee, deflected when asked about seeking McConnell's job, but notably did not say no. A source told the website Axios that Steve Daines appreciates the president's support but needs to focus on taking back the Senate in November. John Thune and John Barrasso have made similar statements suggesting that if they're to announce their own runs at Senate leadership, they will come later down the road. Donald Trump has also told those close to him that he's a fan of John Barrasso, who endorsed the former president in January. John Thune and John Cornyn both criticized Donald Trump in the aftermath of the 6th of January 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol, but they each endorsed him in this fall's election as it became clear he'd run away with a Republican nomination. The website Axios has also covered the same story. Two of the three Johns tapped as potential heirs to outgoing Senate GOP leader Mitch McConnell have faced allegations of disloyalty personally leveled by former President Donald Trump. Mitch McConnell's exit in November is a death knell for the old guard GOP establishment. MAGA is eager to fill the void. Senators John Thune, Republican of South Dakota, and John Cornyn, Republican of Texas, Mitch McConnell deputies, whom Donald Trump has shamed as rhinos, face an uphill climb in their quest to become the next GOP leader. Senator John Barrasso, Republican of Wyoming, who savvily endorsed Donald Trump in January, enters the race as the MAGA-friendly of the three Johns. A sizable block of Republican senators still want their leadership to function as a bulwark against Trumpian excesses, especially given the far-right chaos that has plagued the House GOP majority. John Thune, the number two Senate Republican, agonized over running for re-election in 2022 after Donald Trump attacked him for his refusal to support overturning the results of the 2020 election. John Cornyn, John Thune's predecessor as GOP whip, faced backlash among conservatives in 2022 for his handling of bipartisan gun reform negotiations after the Uvalde, Texas school shooting. The two senators will likely start out as favorites in November's race to replace Mitch McConnell, but the vocal bloc of pro-Trump senators who have taken office since 2017 will complicate their path to a majority. John Thune signaled his willingness to kiss the ring when he finally endorsed Donald Trump on Sunday, but John Cornyn, though he's also endorsed Donald Trump, appears ready to brawl with his MAGA detractors. It will be difficult for Cornyn to be effective leader since he is anti-Trump, anti-gun, and will be focused on his high competitive primary campaign in 2026, tweeted Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton on Wednesday, 28th of February. Hard to run from a prison, Ken, John Cornyn shot back at the indicted Trump surrogate. The British newspaper The Independent has also covered the same story. Senate Republicans have a clear message for former President Donald Trump about the race to replace Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. Stay out of the race. After they got over the initial shock of McConnell's announcement on Wednesday, 28th of February, the race to replace him, namely among the three Johns, Senate Minority Whip John Thune, Senate Republican Conference Chairman John Barrasso, and Senator John Cornyn of Texas, has begun at a quick pace. Journalists Steph Kite and Stephen Neukamp told Axios website that Donald Trump wants National Republican Senatorial Committee Chairman Steve Daines of Montana to run for the job. But Republicans expressed skepticism about Donald Trump playing a role in replacing Mitch McConnell, his longtime nemesis. Unsurprisingly, some of the Republicans who voted to convict Trump for his actions on 6th of January 2021 don't want him to have a role at all. Senator Lisa Murkowski said, "I don't," before brushing off a question from The Independent. Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana didn't want Donald Trump to intervene. "He should play no role whatsoever," he said, saying that it would cross lines between the executive and legislative branches of the government, and the executive should not be picking the leadership of a congressional body, period, end of the story. That may not come as a surprise given their dislike of Donald Trump, but even more pro-Trump Republicans say the former president will not have as much sway. The Republican conference picks the leader, Senator Debbie Fisher of Nebraska, who endorsed Donald Trump, told The Independent. Senator Mark Wayne Mullen of Oklahoma told The Independent that the conference needed to sort it out themselves. "I believe the Senate works its will out on the leader, but I think it's helpful for whoever's going to be the leader to have good relationship with our, hopefully our next president," Senator Mullen told The Independent. When asked whether it would be helpful for Donald Trump to endorse a candidate, he said, "As long as it's the candidate that I'm supporting." Of course, Donald Trump never shies away from saying whatever he wants to say, and Senate Republicans know this very well. But even Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, one of the most hard-right Republicans who regularly dabbles in conspiracy theories, said that Senate Republicans had to handle the matter and said emphatically that it would not serve Republicans' interests for Donald Trump to support someone in the race. IRIB English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to IRIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
On the occasion of the 40th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, February 11th, 2019, the global scene today witnesses a phenomena that are unfolding or will unfold in the near future. The new dynamism of the Islamic Awakening movement based on the model of resistance to the US and Zionist domination. The new dynamism of the Islamic Awakening movement based on the model of resistance to the US and Zionist domination. The failure of U.S. policies in the West Asian region and the defeat of their traitorous allies in the region. The expansion of the powerful political presence of the Islamic Republic of Iran in West Asia and its wide-ranging reflection across the world of domineering powers. These are examples of the reputation of the Islamic Republic, which were not achieved except by means of the courage and wisdom of the jihadi, selflessly striving managers.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The leaders of the domineering system are worried. Their proposals generally involve deception and lies. Today, the Iranian nation, in addition to the criminal regime of the United States, regards a number of European governments as deceiving and unreliable. The Islamic Republic of Iran must prudently observe its boundaries with them. It should not retreat from its revolutionary and national values. It should not be scared by their void threats. And at all times, it should consider the dignity of the country and try to wisely, prudently, and of course with a revolutionary standpoint, settle the solvable problems it has in relations with them. In the case of the United States, no problem with them is seen to be resolved, and any negotiation with the US will have no outcome but material and spiritual harms. There are many necessary points to make in this regard. Lifestyle. I will leave it to another opportunity, and it suffice to mention that the West's attempts to promote the Western lifestyle in Iran has caused a lot of irreversible moral, economic, religious, and political detriments to our country and our nation.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You got guiding me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I want to thank you for bringing me home.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Italian cities were the scene of rallies in solidarity with Gaza and in condemnation of Israel's inhuman attacks against Palestinian civilians. Rome, Florence, Pisa, Syracuse, Grosseto, for the umpteenth time since early October, tens of thousands of people across Italy took to the streets of their respective cities to express their anger at the Italian government for unconditionally supporting the Israeli regime and at the international community for its complicity in Gaza genocide.
Today, more than ever, international law is just an abstract set of norms which prevails over humanity. Millions of people have died since the Sykes-Picot Accord over 100 years ago, and we're still arguing over the fact that Palestine is a state or not.
We'll go down in history as those who silently supported the genocide period.
Italy has not condemned Israel for the killing of unarmed Palestinians collecting aid in Gaza in an attack that killed more than 100 people on Thursday. However, Rome has called on the Israeli regime to investigate the incident and bring the perpetrators behind the aid massacre to justice.
The Italian police crackdown on students during Palestine solidarity demonstrations in the past weeks has sparked outrage across Italy. Student collectives are at loggerheads with Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni and police over the rise in attacks against students.
The government and police repression has revealed the bare truth. Our country is a democracy only on paper. Ours are simply the democracies of double standards and deception. We have been attacked during our protest for peace in Ukraine, and we are attacked today. We perfectly know how democracies work in Western countries.
Thousands of artists, curators and critics have signed an open letter calling on the Venice Biennale, one of the world's largest contemporary visual art exhibitions, to exclude the Israeli National Pavilion from this year's art exhibition due to the brutal assaults against the civilians in Gaza. However, Italy's culture minister has firmly backed Israel's participation. Max Civili, Rome.
Across France, supporters of Palestine marched to denounce Israel's constant atrocities and war crimes during their latest invasion of Gaza. The world has been stunned by what's been dubbed the Flower Massacre, the death of over 100 Palestinians and the wounding of nearly 800 others after Israeli troops opened fire on civilians waiting for food.
We are here to ask for sanctions and to expose the hypocrisy of those who say they were shocked by the killing of people starving that were getting humanitarian aid, but at the same time don't do anything to stop the genocide.
Some 600,000 people in Gaza, or 25% of the population, are currently at risk of famine.
The French Foreign Ministry said the shootings were unjustifiable and backed a call for an independent investigation by the United Nations. French President Emmanuel Macron demanded truth, justice, respect for international law, and called for an immediate ceasefire.
In the Western world, which is and remains accomplice
with the Israeli genocide, but a slight change in the tone of all those Western leaders, including Emmanuel Macron. Remember that a few months ago, Macron was proposing a military coalition to fight the Palestinian resistance in Gaza.
4 years ago, Macron forced through a bill which equated anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, despite the obvious differences between the two.